watched a figure walk out of that doorway, cut across the hall, and walk into the wall.
And I was scared. I thought they was coming toward me, you know, because they acted like they was going to come toward me. And something like that just, you know, just freezes you, just puts you right there, you know, in the spot. You know, you don't know what to do.
There's so many different types of aliens. I mean, billions. As far as planets like Earth, there's billions upon billions of planets like Earth.
Shifted in front of their eyes from a human form into a reptilian form and then back again.
I'm open-minded about a lot of strange phenomena.
For the past 3 years, a large number of perfectly sane and reliable people have been involved in this flying saucer business. Even those of us who have never seen one have become involved. We read about them, talk about them, wonder about these reports of strange phenomena in the sky.
Mountains. This is Speaking of Strange with Joshua P. Warren, the show that explores today's mysteries and the groundbreaking knowledge of tomorrow. It's alive. It's alive from Asheville, North Carolina. And tonight, pump up the volume behind your 4th of July cookouts. It's a special edition. To those of you in the Southeast and around the globe on the Internet, welcome to the region's top-rated Saturday night talk program that gives you breaking news and insight regarding the paranormal and downright weird, where the unusual becomes usual. And we don't just discuss it. We go in the field to investigate. It is July 3rd, 2010. On this date in 1775, George Washington took control of the Continental Army in Massachusetts. And on this date last year, John Keel died at age 79. He was a fantastic author and investigator. His most famous book was The Mothman Prophecies. It's required reading for a paranormalist. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, author of books like Haunted Asheville, How to Hunt Ghosts, and The Secret Wisdom of Kukulkan. And I'm founder and president of Lemur Paranormal Investigations. My producer and engineer tonight is Manny the Man Creech. Good evening, Manny. Very well. Good to party here with all of our friends strewn around this grand old planet. Because you, my dear listeners, are about to hear the fantastic. And remember, if you want to participate in the show when phone lines are open, it is a 4th of July weekend special. And it has some to do with winning America through secrecy. Tonight, crank up the show behind your cookouts. Enjoy a fun evening. I will be joined by my friend and fellow paranormal author, Englishman Nick Redfern. He now lives in the United States and will discuss how the English view the 4th of July in this country. And also, Nick's new book, Monsters of Texas, will be out soon. So we'll dig into that and see what monsters may be lurking in the hot summer vegetation around your house. Don't forget, if you can, go to speakingofstrange.com to participate in the live chat during the show. Find more information on topics discussed, plus links to some really cool stuff updated as often as possible. And in fact, right now, I've got some interesting clips for you at joshuapwarren.com. I went on Coast to Coast AM Thursday night. Of course, I do regular segments there for the paranormal moment. And I actually have a clip posted there that will show you how we have created orbs in the laboratory artificially. And there is an additional link there that if you, it's a video clip that you must see if you've never seen it. We've talked about it on this show, but it is one of the best videos of an imprint I've ever seen. It looks like a Civil War soldier at Gettysburg stepping over a non-existent wall. I won't be redundant and talk about the things I discussed on Coast to Coast, but you really should go look at this and understand that if we can figure out how ghostly phenomena is created and back engineer it, then we might someday be able to create a device that allows us to look into the past
and see definitively what has happened before us, for better or for worse. And we might dig some into that tonight, because obviously it's intriguing to think about the fact that the 4th of July is the celebration of this sort of ragtag group of colonists who had very little money, who had little organization, who decided to gamble their lives, their fortunes, everything they had, on fighting the largest, most advanced, wealthy military in the entire world. And the reason they were able to win was by focusing on secrecy. So we'll dig into that some, and pretty soon, I think it's important for me to give you a little update and maybe a clearer picture of what happened over 60 years ago, 4th of July weekend, in a little town called Roswell, New Mexico, because sure enough, it was around the 4th of July when this object crashed there. So very fitting to imagine the spectacular fiery display that came blasting down into the desert that night. And in fact, every 4th of July, they have a big convention there in Roswell, and they get together and everybody touches base on the latest. So I've got a little special information I want to pass along to you there. And in order to help us dig through this maze of sensational subject matter, as usual, the woman whose duty is perhaps toughest of all to balance out all of the raging testosterone that Manny and I broadcast with the feminine balance of the yin, shall we say, the karmic symmetry that can only be introduced by investigator Shelley Wright. Welcome to the show, Shelley.
Thank you.
And in fact, Monday, you're back at work, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else has the day off, but I will be working.
Because we were talking last week about visiting Shelley so you can stalk her, get her autograph, whatever you want, at Wright's Coin Shop. And that's your family's business,
right,
over there near the Asheville Mall across from Kmart. You guys have been in business over 30 years.
Yes.
But you guys were closed all past week.
We were closed. We were closed. You couldn't call me or stalk me or get my autograph or just look at me or talk to me about gold or silver.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just going to have to come in on Monday. We'll be there bright and early.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 10:30, bright and early
for me.
And, Kmart Shopping Center across from the Asheville Mall.
All right, very good. And, you know, people go over there and they visit you guys because they want to sort of transform their money into more money because the currency is so unstable. In fact, you know, the world is in such a weird state. I want to give a quick programming note here because, you know, I'm doing these coast-to-coast AM segments, as I have for quite a while now, and I'm about to do some traveling. I'll be out there on the road. I'll be investigating some places and bringing back reports for Coast. And also, before you know it, it's going to be that time of year when there are sports being broadcast sometimes instead of Speaking of Strange. So it always gets a little bit wishy-washy as we push through the summer and head into the fall. So just listen, if you want to make sure that you know what I'm up to, and I'm maybe looking into some other options to be able to deliver reports on what kind of work I'm up to, just be sure that you go to my website, joshuapwarren.com, and sign up for the free and spam-free e-newsletter there so I can contact you directly. Because sometimes we don't know if the show is going to be preempted for some reason, or, you know, the computers could crash and, you know, the whole operation could go down in flames. Anything is possible. So just, you know, make sure that you are on the website as a subscriber, and I can let you know what's going on. So, yes, there are numerous things for us to dig into tonight. And when we come back from our first break, I want to talk some about this Roswell situation and paint a portrait for you that I think maybe you've never seen that will give you a greater sense of the texture and the colors and the emotions and the confusion that people were observing and enduring when this incident first happened. Because now you find that when something becomes a cliched part of history, after a while, people forget about exactly what made it so interesting to begin with. And it's important to readdress that once in a while. And it's interesting to me that, you know, when you think of the 4th of July, you also have to think of that incident, which involved the military and the way we control our government, as well as the formation of our government. And this is just amazing to me. I've got a story here. And apparently a survey has been done asking Americans who we declared independence from in 1776, and 26% of the Americans surveyed had no idea. That's over a quarter of Americans. And in fact, one of the questions was, who was emperor when the United States declared independence from China? Give up? Yeah, and it's true. They talked to Americans who said that we had separated from France, Japan, Mexico, Spain, or yes, even China. And, you know, we obviously separated from Great Britain, but I don't know what's happening nowadays when you have that level, you know, that segment, that ratio of your country that has no sense of its identity. And that is one reason, as I talked about on Coast to Coast, it's important to look back at your history, because not only does that form your character and your identity, but as we've all heard, you're doomed to repeat the mistakes of your history. According to this report, they say looking at the numbers more deeply, it appears the closer to 1776 you were born, the more likely you are to know the correct answer. So, in other words, the young people have somehow made it through a good chunk of their lives without understanding this. And I tell you something else I've always found was kind of quirky. Have you guys ever seen the movie The Madness of King George? Well, it's a great film. I highly recommend it. And I'm sure that the people who have no idea that we broke away from England certainly have no idea who was in control of the British royalty, and that was King George. He actually was going insane around the time of the American Revolution. And I've often thought that it's interesting to think he probably was, to some extent, such a poor ruler because of this true medical, clinical, mental instability that he was suffering. Because, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, there's a whole big list of charges that was leveled about, here is why we're declaring independence. And a lot of them singled out King George in particular, and things that he had done they felt were unethical. And it's weird to me to think that there was a time in this world when one man had so much power and so much influence that all he had to do was start losing his mind, and it eventually formed what is now the most powerful country in the world. And that's the problem when you have a system where one individual has that level of influence and control over a kingdom. But even though he was insane, and he ended up at the end of his life completely out of his mind, he would sit around rambling for days and days till he was hoarse. You know, he couldn't even talk anymore. He was still difficult to beat the English, and the only way the Americans were able to do it was through secrecy, Freemason relationships, a lot of shady deals behind closed doors and back rooms, going to some of these weird places like the Hellfire Club in parts of England and France. Very bizarre twists of fate that were happening in 1776, 234 years ago. But we'll take a break. When we come back, I will tell you something I find interesting about the Roswell incident, and then we're going to work our way into some of the secrecy that formed the birth of this nation. It's the show where the unusual becomes usual. We discuss the remarkable, the amazing, the fantastic, the downright weird, keeping you company every time. It's called Speaking of Strange.
This is Speaking of Strange, It's more than a show. It's a saga. An epic struggle between man and the beyond. Between us and the unexplained. We are the favorite program of Hodags, Wendigos, Skunk Apes, Little People, and Space Aliens.
And tonight, on the eve of July 4th, do we reflect on how 234 years ago, a nation of people with little money, yet rich in spirit, envisioned a government of personal freedom without regard to royalty or religion, able to defeat the largest, most powerful, and organized military in the world by using secret symbolism and shady backroom deals, forming a shadow government to work behind the scenes and form Francis Bacon's vision of a new world order. Yes! And tonight, Englishman Nick Redfern will join us to discuss how the British view of our July 4th and the secrecy that pervades our government functions to this very day. And next week on the program, I think we're going to tackle a tiny little simple subject called the meaning of life. So put that on your calendar. We're going to explain it all. That and more is next Saturday, July 10th, 2010, right here. Now, we all have heard over and over again throughout the years about the Roswell situation. And I have been to Roswell. I spent a week there working on a major program with the Discovery Channel. We had our own airplane and a little helicopter with a camera on it and all this thermal imaging technology, and we discovered some pretty wild stuff. And eventually, even though hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent to put this together, suddenly the people in charge of the project at Discovery more or less vanished, and our results were locked away in a vault somewhere in Silver Springs, Maryland, next to the NSA building. So there's a lot of conspiracy swirling around that particular project, which just adds to the mystique that people discuss when they bring up what happened in Roswell. Well, here's what I want to do for you. This is something that I don't do very often, but I think it's a fitting occasion. There was this book published in 1997, which was 50 years after the incident. It was called The Day After Roswell, and it was written by Colonel Philip J. Corso, who is now deceased. He published this right before he died. And Philip J. Corso was a very esteemed man. He was a key Army intelligence officer who served on General MacArthur's staff in Korea and later on Dwight D. Eisenhower's National Security Council as a lieutenant colonel. And during his 21-year military career, he was honored with 19 medals, decorations, and ribbons for meritorious service. He retired from the Army in 1963 and went on to serve Senators James Eastland and Strom Thurmond as a staff member specializing in national security. Then he went on to work for various private sector businesses as a consultant and contracts administrator. He went on Primetime Live as an expert commentator on Cold War U-2 flights over Russia, and has testified before the House National Security Committee about the American POWs held in North Korea. So how shocking it was when he wrote this book claiming that he was given the duty of collecting all of the technology from the spaceship that crashed in Roswell and gradually disseminating it both to sects of the military and to private contractors, so that they could develop this technology over time, such as the transistor, the laser, fiber optics, all these kinds of things. Now, this has been very controversial, and a lot of people say that this is ridiculous, but he was quite adamant about this being his role for research and development. And so what I'd like to do here is to read you just the first few pages of this book, because he opens this book up by giving you, he gives you sort of a painting, a mental picture of what exactly happened that night with everything that he came to learn over the years. Because once this was discovered, and the military became involved, well, it instantly became a hall of mirrors. And, you know, we ended up with people who made deathbed confessions saying that, you know, they had to stay quiet their whole lives, they were threatened, that this was definitely a craft from another place that had space beings on it, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting to look at the days before the military became involved and just see what he was able to dig up. So here we go. Few pages for you, and of course I'll pause for the break because I know that I won't make it through it before the upcoming break. But just, you know, you might want to close your eyes and envision this, especially if you've never been out there to the deserts of Roswell. The night hugs the ground and swallows you up as you drive out of Albuquerque and into the desert. As you head east along 40 and then south along 285 to Roswell, there's only you and the tiny universe ahead of you defined by your headlights. On either side, beyond the circle of light, there is only scrub and sand. The rest is all darkness that closes in behind you, flooding where you've been under a giant ocean of black, and pushes you forward along the few hundred feet of road directly ahead. The sky is different out there, different from any sky you've ever seen before. The black is so clear, it looks like the stars shining through it are tiny windows from the beginning of time, millions of them going on forever. On a hot summer night, you can sometimes see flashes of heat lightning explode in the distance. Somewhere it is light for an instant, and then the darkness returns. But summer is the rainy season in the New Mexico desert, and thunderstorms assemble over you out of nowhere, pound the earth with rain and lightning, pummel the darkness with crashes of thunder, shake the ground until you feel the earth is breaking apart, and then disappear. The ranchers out there will tell you that the local storms can go on all night, bouncing off the arroyos like pinballs in play until they expend themselves over the horizon. That's what it was like 50 years ago, on a night much like this. Although I wasn't there that night, I've heard many different versions, and many of them go like this. Base radar at the Army's 509th airfield outside the town of Roswell had been tracking strange blips all night on July 1, 1947. So had radar at nearby White Sands, the Army's guided missile base where test launches of German V-2 rockets had been taking place since the end of the war, and at the nuclear testing facility at Alamogordo. The blips would appear at one corner of the screen and dart across at seemingly impossible speeds for aircraft, only to disappear off another corner. Then they'd start up again. No earthly craft could have maneuvered at such speeds and changed direction so sharply. It was a signature no one could identify. Whether it was the same aircraft, more than one, or simply an anomaly from the violent lightning and thunderstorms was anybody's guess. So after the operators verified the calibrations of the radar equipment, they broke down the units to run diagnostic checks on the circuitry of the screen imaging devices to make sure their radar panels were operating properly. And once they'd satisfied themselves that they could not report any equipment malfunction, the controllers were forced to assume that the screen images were displays of something that was truly out there. They confirmed the sightings with radar controllers at White Sands, but found they could do little else but track the blips as they darted across the screen with every sweep of the silent beacon. The blips swarmed from position to position at will, operating with complete freedom across the entire sky over the Army's most secret nuclear and missile testing sites. Throughout that night and the following day, Army intelligence stayed on high alert because something strange was going on out there. Surveillance flights over the desert reported no sightings of strange objects, either in the sky or on the ground. But any sighting of unidentified aircraft on radar was sufficient evidence for base commanders to assume a hostile intent on the part of something. And that was why the Army Intelligence in Washington ordered additional counterintelligence personnel to New Mexico, especially to the 509th, where the activity seemed to be centered. The radar anomalies continued into the night as Dan Wilmot, owner of a hardware store in Roswell, set up chairs on his front porch after dinner to watch the streaks of lightning flash across the sky in the distance. And shortly before 10 that evening, the lightning grew more intense and the ground shook under the explosions of thunder from a summer storm that pounded the Chaparral off in the northwest of the city. Dan and his wife watched the spectacle from beneath the dry safety of their porch roof. It was as if each new bolt of lightning were a spear that rent the heavens themselves. Better than any 4th of July fireworks, the Wilmots must have been remarking as they watched in awe as a bright oval object streaked over their house and headed off into the northwest, sinking below a rise just before the horizon, where it was engulfed in darkness. The sky again became pitch black. By the time the next bolt of lightning shot off, the object was gone. A most unusual sight, Dan Wilmot thought, but it was gone from his sight, and gone from his thoughts, at least until the end of the week. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll tell you what other people saw that night, and how it all came together into what could be one of the grandest experiences and encounters that has shaped our country since its inception. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.
Yeah. Let's take them back. Coming up, I was confused. My mama kissing the girl. Confusion occurs coming up in the cold world. Daddy ain't around, probably out committing felonies. My favorite rapper used to sing, check out my melody. I wanna live good. Still, four finger ring. One of them go ropes. Santa told me if I pass, I get a sheep skin coat. I can move to get the hat. Now that'll be built. Tossed and turned in my sleep that night. Woke up the next morning, stole my fight. Different day, same. Nothing good in the hood. I run away from this bitch and never come back if I could. Need a love. The underdog's on top, and I'm gon' shine, homie, until my heart stops.
Go ahead and be me. I'm Rash MVP, and I ain't going nowhere, so you can get to know me.
Need a love. The underdog's on top, and I'm gon' shine, homie, until my heart stops.
Go ahead and be me. I'm Rash MVP, and I ain't going nowhere, so you can get to know me.
This is Speaking of Strange, hey, from Asheville, North Carolina, land of the sky, and I am your host, Joshua P. Warren. It is 63 years since something crashed in Roswell, New Mexico, just nearby, actually. There is no debate over that. Something crashed. What was it? Keep in mind, the most secret project that the military ever worked on up until then was the development of the atomic bomb. This was being done in New Mexico. And it was finally delivered. It was delivered from the Roswell base. These were the most talented, capable aviators in the world with the highest security clearance. They delivered the bomb, and then not too long afterward, something crashes there. The people who found it said, oh, this is otherworldly. They published a newspaper press release, flying disc captured. But then immediately the cover-up kicked in. The general came down. Blanchard, I believe, was his name. Said, no, this was just a balloon. And a lot of those people, like Jesse Marcel, he was ticked off the rest of his life that his credibility was undermined. And do you know that whatever this thing was that crashed, the timing becomes even more interesting because 18 days later, President Truman signed the National Security Act, forming the Air Force, laying the grounds for the CIA and the NSA and all of these compartmentalizations of intelligence. Well, in his book, The Day After Roswell, the deceased Colonel Philip J. Corso tells us more about what was seen there before the military machine kicked in. let us continue. Keep in mind, it was around the 4th of July, about 63 years ago, if my math is correct. I was telling you about Dan Wilmot sitting on his porch, seeing this object that looked like a bright oval streaking over his house. Now, whatever it was that passed over the Wilmot house in Roswell also flew over Steve Robinson as he drove his milk truck along its route north of the city. Robinson tracked the object as it shot across the sky at speeds faster than any airplane he'd ever seen. It was a bright object, he noted, elliptical and solid, rather than a sequence of lights like the military aircraft that flew in and out of the 509th airfield on the city's outskirts. It disappeared behind a rise off in the west toward Albuquerque, and Steve put it out of his mind as he pushed forward on his route. To the civilians in Roswell, nothing was amiss. Summer thunderstorms were common. The reports of flying saucers in the newspapers and over the radio were simply circus sideshow amusements, and an object streaking across the sky that so attracted the Wilmots' attention could have been nothing more than a shooting star, perhaps, that you'd make a wish on if you're lucky enough to see it just before it disappears forever in a puff of flame. Soon it would be the July 4th weekend, and the Wilmots, Steve Robinson, thousands of other local residents were looking forward to the unofficial start of the summer holiday. But at the 509th, there was no celebrating. The isolated incidents of unidentified radar blips at Roswell and White Sands continued to increase over the next couple of days until it looked like a steady stream of airspace violations. Now it was becoming more than serious. There was no denying that a traffic pattern of strange aircraft overflights was emerging in the skies over the New Mexico desert, where, with impunity, these unidentifiable radar blips hovered above and then darted away from our most secret military installations. By the time the military's own aircraft scrambled, the intruders were gone. It was obvious to the base commanders that they were under a heavy surveillance from a presence they could only assume was hostile. At first, nobody gave much thought to the possibility of extraterrestrials or flying saucers, even though they'd been in the news for the past few weeks in spring. Army officers at the 509th and White Sands thought it was the Russians spying on the military's first nuclear bomber base and its guided missile launching site. By now, Army counterintelligence, this highly secret command sector, which in 1947 operated almost as much in the civilian sector as it did in the military, had spun up to its highest alert and ordered a full deployment of its most experienced crack World War II operatives out to Roswell. CIC personnel had begun to arrive from Washington when the first reports of strange radar blips were filed through intelligence channels and kept coming as the reports continued to pile up with increasing urgency over the next 48 hours. Officers and enlisted men alike disembarked from the transport planes and changed into civilian clothes for the investigation into enemy activities in the area. They joined up with base intelligence officers like Major Jesse Marcel and Steve Arnold, a counterintelligence non-com who'd served at the Roswell base during World War II, when the first nuclear bombing mission against Hiroshima was launched from there in August 1945, just about 2 years earlier. On the evening of July 4, 1947, though the dates may differ depending on who is telling the story, while the rest of the country was celebrating Independence Day and looking with great optimism at the costly peace that the sacrifice of its soldiers had brought, radar operators at sites around Roswell noticed that the strange objects were turning up again and again and looked almost as if they were changing their shapes on the screen. They were pulsating. It was the only way you could describe it. Glowing more intensely and then dimly as tremendous thunderstorms broke out over the desert. Steve Arnold posted to the Roswell Airfield Control Tower that evening. He had never seen a blip behave like that as it darted across the screen between sweeps at speeds over 1,000 miles an hour, And all the while it was pulsating, throbbing almost, until while the skies over the base exploded in a biblical display of thunder and lightning, it arced to the lower left-hand quadrant of the screen, seemed to disappear for a moment, and then exploded in a brilliant white fluorescence and evaporated right before his very eyes. The screen was clear. The blips were gone. And as controllers looked around at each other and at the CIC officers in the room, the same thought arose in all their minds. An object, whatever it was, had crashed. The military response was put into motion within seconds. This was a national security issue. Jump on that thing in the desert and bring it back before anyone else could find it. That's all I'll read to you from The Day After Roswell by Colonel Philip J. Corso. We know mostly what happened after that point when they did find it. And then all of the misinformation began to swirl around. And all I can tell you is that maybe 5 years ago, when I was in Roswell, along with Nick Redfern and other great investigators like Jim Mars, Brian Irish, and we'll talk about this soon when he's on the program, when we were there, all those years later, out in the middle of that desert, still looking around to see if we might be fortunate enough to find some scrap, some energy field, some impact, we were being observed the whole time, off in the distance, white vehicles sitting there on federally restricted property, looking at us with telescopic lenses. We even got pulled over and detained by the Roswell Police Department on our way to the crash site without any explanation. A lot of weird stuff happened in Roswell during the time we were there. I could go on and on about it, but I've talked about it before. So now reflect on, all these years later, what that might have meant for our country if we did have access to this technology, which of course set into motion this incredible series of developments that we are now reaping fully to this day. Secrecy. Secrecy has always been our greatest tool. When we come back, I'll tell you a little bit about some of the secrecy that was used by our founders, the Masonic influences in early American history, and ask yourself, why is it that a country like the United States of America, that has never had pyramids, has a huge pyramid on its dollar bill, capped with the all-seeing eye of the Illuminati? I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the show where the unusual becomes usual. Speaking of strange,
I'm not afraid to
final minutes of hour number one on tonight's special 4th of July edition of Speaking Strange. And I'm Joshua P. Warren. Soon we will be joined by Nick Redfern, a man who has spent a lot of time in Roswell, and he's also an Englishman. We'll talk to him about the way the English feel regarding the 4th of July in this country. And if there's any doubt about the fact that our founders were able to win that war against impossible odds due to secrecy, look at who they were up against. A bunch of guys who wore bright red coats and stood out on a field in line. That is as obvious and as non-secretive as you could be. That was the clash of secrecy versus the obvious, and that's why we won. We snooped around, and we used guerrilla tactics, and these guys like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, they were considered terrorists by the crown. You know, people like them were to be executed on sight. There is a list here of what many historians consider to be the 20 greatest names of the American Revolution, and at least half of them were Masons. Three of them were probably Masons. The list of definite Masons were Ethan Allen, Edmund Burke, John Claypool, William Dawes, John Hancock, John Paul Jones, Robert Livingston, Paul Revere, Colonel Benjamin Tupper, and George Washington. Some of the guys who weren't confirmed Masons had some Masonic connections that made it look like they were involved in utilizing the secrecy. Daniel Webster, he had some evidence. John Adams spoke favorably of Freemasonry, but supposedly never joined. We don't know for sure. But think about it, you know, now you hear about a lodge, and you just take for granted, oh, that's a place that, you know, where Masons hang out. But back then, you know, a lodge was literally a lodge. You know, when you would travel around and you would arrive in a new town and you didn't know anybody, you would go and stay in a lodge that was owned by Freemasons, and they would welcome you in as a brother. And that, you know, that those were your accommodations, and that's where people would sit down and be able to speak freely about these subversive ideas that would have gotten you executed otherwise. And if you want to look at some of the credible Masonic influences in early American history, Lafayette, French liaison to the colonies, without whose aid the war could not have been won, was a Mason. The majority of the commanders of the Continental Army were Freemasons and members of Army lodges. Most of General Washington's generals were Freemasons. The Boston Tea Party was planned at the Green Dragon Tavern, also known as the Freemasons' Arms and the headquarters of the Revolution. George Washington was sworn in as the first President of the United States by Robert Livingston, Grand Master of New York's Masonic Lodge. The Bible on which he took his oath was from his own Masonic Lodge. The cornerstone of the Capitol building was laid by the Grand Lodge of Maryland. And there are many instances throughout history, not just in the Revolution, but in other times of war, when the enemy has been saved from execution by giving a Masonic distress sign. One of the most prominent happened after the Alamo. Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. He was a practicing Freemason, and he displayed the Masonic Brother in Distress sign to Sam Houston, another Freemason, after his capture. And this probably saved him from almost immediate hanging and certainly contributed to the VIP treatment that he got from a lot of the officials in Texas, most of whom were Masons. It's a part of our history, secrecy. How far, how deep does it go? We're going to talk about a lot of things that are mysterious related to the history of our country. It's the appropriate time to do it, 4th of July weekend. When we come back, we will have Mr. Nick Redfern with us. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's Speaking of Strange, the show where the unusual becomes usual.